Good afternoon once again. Hi, this is Jack Hopke. We are here at WWNO, and we are here in New Orleans. And we live in a medium-sized city, but we share all the concerns and problems of the largest urban areas. And in some cases, especially meteorological, for instance, ours are sometimes even more pronounced. We'll look at a number of those situations on this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. Our perspectives today look from the past and future as well as the present. They also incorporate the viewpoints of observers and analysts from outside our immediate environs as well as from right here in our midst. I hope you find today's features enlightening and encouraging. We'll also tell you how you can participate in setting priorities for the future of New Orleans. Welcome again to All Things New Orleans on this Monday. There are more than 5,300 inmates at Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. Nearly 4,000 of them are serving life without parole. And last month, the Angola Prison Drama Club staged a play unlike any other in the prison's experience. It was called The Life of Jesus Christ. It featured 70 inmates, men and women, acting together for the first time in costume with a real camel, performing for the general public. For these untrained actors, this production held special meaning, as each actor seemed to see a piece of his or her own life revealed in the characters. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Get going! Keep moving!
The Roman soldier who executes Jesus is played by Terrence Williams, a muscular convicted murderer who's doing time for his earlier role as an assassin for a drug-dealing gang on the streets of New Orleans.
Move!
The centurion's armor is cast-off football pads. His shield is cut from a plastic garbage can. His thick arms are covered with prison tattoos. Williams is in his 17th year of a life sentence here at Angola.
I used to sell drugs on the street. I was involved with a large drug trade. Things went haywire out there. People wind up dead. I got charged with murder, you know, more than once. And here I am. I left with my hands bloody. You know, I was a hitman on the street. But here I am in prison playing a character in the life of Jesus Christ. So who's to say we can't change? And I think what me and the guys are doing, this is a way to say that we are making amends for the crimes that brought us to this situation in our lives at this point.
It's not possible during a one-day visit to watch the first day's performance to know whether these inmate actors who've been sentenced to a penitentiary have become penitent, sorrowful for their sins, or whether they have changed, as many are quick to tell a reporter. Some, indeed, say that they're innocent. Many of the inmates interviewed, however, say that their roles in this play have deeply affected them.
My name is Saray Kong. I play the role of the Virgin Mary. I'm doing a 15-year sentence for armed robbery. I was born in Cambodia, but I was raised in New Orleans since I was 2 years old.
Kong, who's 31 years old, has spent a third of her life in the Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women in St. Gabriel, an hour and a half bus ride away. She's one of 19 women taking part in the play. Kong says the role of Mary has helped her deal with a trauma she experienced as a teenager that she'd never spoken about until now.
They said Mary is either 14, 15, something like that, and when I was that age, I came up pregnant. I ended up having an abortion, and Mary gave birth to God. And I don't know, doing this part is kind of healing for me in a sense with the abortion that I had at 14, you know.
The Life of Jesus Christ was staged over 3 days in May inside the rodeo arena at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. About 1,200 people saw the production, prisoners in jeans and T-shirts, relatives, church groups, and a few curious members of the public. They applauded appreciatively in the sticky southern heat. The title role of Jesus is played by Bobby Wallace.
I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana, Algiers. I'm in here for two armed robberies. I have 66 years flat. I have 2 years left before I go off for parole.
In the Last Supper scene, Wallace wears prison shower slippers and a tunic of white muslin donated to the production.
Love one another as I have loved you. No greater love than this, that a man lays down his life for his friends.
Well, what then must we do now, Lord?
I appoint you to go out and teach the world as I have taught you.
Bobby Wallace and many of the male actors are members of the Angola Drama Club, as well as students of the Baptist Theological Seminary, the first prison seminary of its kind in the nation, created by the longtime warden, Burl Kane. Wallace says he was surprised when he was selected for the lead role during a two-week acting workshop, but he's grateful.
Jesus was considered to be a criminal. He was being punished for what he believed in, let me say that. I identify with him on some parts because he was condemned.
The Angola prison farm, named for the birthplace of the slaves who once worked this ground when it was a plantation, is unique in American penology. At 28 square miles, it's the largest maximum security prison in the United States and has the nation's largest number of lifers. Tucked in a bend of the Mississippi River, the rolling green fields and the placid lake inside the prison boundaries can be a surprising sight for inmates from other prisons.
When I leave Louisiana State Institution for Women, it's like I'm free.
Michelle Allen is serving a life sentence at the St. Gabriel prison as a habitual offender. She plays the leper who's healed by Jesus. Her effusive description of Angola might not be shared by the lifers here or the men on death row, locked up 23 hours a day in a cell block down by the river. But Allen appreciates any change of routine.
The scenery is beautiful. Just to be able to walk and stretch, just to be able to sit on something different, to look at something different.
Nice to be around men?
Of course, it's always nice to be around men. After being locked up 16 years, who wouldn't want to be around a man?
As the actors lounge on the bleachers, the chaplain calls out their character when it's time for their radio interview.
Satan, are you here?
A bearded man with thick features, one of the few white inmates in the play, sits down and smiles nervously.
My name is David Saunier Jr., and I play the devil in the temptation scene. I'm from Jennerette, Louisiana. I was convicted of aggravated rape, and I have a life sentence here at Angola.
His character is hauntingly effective.
Well, to draw in from my life, I mean, it's just a lot of the anger, you know, that I've had from when I was younger and stuff. A lot of being, you know, when I was young, I was small, I was fat, pushed around, and just using that as a basis to bring life towards this character. It's a challenging role because you have to play all that is evil. Every one of us, we all go through a time in our life where we do have those temptations. We do have those demons that come to us and tell us, do this, do that, I will give you this, you know. And basically, that's kind of where I went with that scene, was just to take him and just make him just as unholy as possible and just as evil as I can make him sound.
In a similar vein, Lavelle Tolliver draws from his turbulent life to play the betrayer of Jesus. Tolliver is serving a life sentence for murder. His anguished portrayal of Judas Iscariot creates one of the most hair-raising scenes of the production.
But Lord, I beg your forgiveness. This burden is too much for me to bear.
I was a murderer. I was a thief. I was a conniver. Yeah, I was all those things. I've committed all kinds of sins, man. And that's how I relate to the character in which I'm playing, because that's what Judas was. Judas was a conniver.
I mean, you really played it with a lot of emotion. How do you get into character?
Oh, man, that's I just try to think about a lot of the wrong things I did, a lot of the hurt I've caused a lot of people. And that pretty much, I could find my way in the character like that.
This passion play was first performed on the grounds of a Scottish castle. An assistant warden named Kathy Fontenot heard about it and decided it would be a good fit for Angola. A community theater director named Suzanne Lostis came over from Edinburgh to Angola to oversee the production. She meets the cast after the first day's performance.
But I thought you were fantastic!
The men and women actors, who are separated when they're off stage, are beaming.
As we say in Scotland, you are pure dead brilliant!
The inmate director is Gary Tyler, who was convicted at 17 for shooting a 13-year-old white boy in a trial his advocates say was tainted with racial prejudice. He's 38 years into a life sentence. Tyler has been president of the Angola Drama Club for more than 2 decades of his incarceration. The club normally performs a couple of skits a month for inmate audiences. There's never been anything on the grand scale of the life of Jesus Christ.
Hearing a response from the audience and being able to feel the exhilaration and excitement from you all, this is my response to all of you. Good job, well done.
The special circumstances of the play do not, however, allow the cast to circumvent that most familiar routine of prison life, the count. Their dormitories have tree names.
All right, fellas, y'all listen up. Just like we've been doing, y'all line it up in the arena so we can get a head count. Y'all ready? Oak one. Oak one.
And with that, Jesus, the apostles, the Pharisees, the shepherds, Pontius Pilate, Barabbas, and all the rest wait their turn to be counted so the guards can make sure that no one has escaped.
Oak three. Oak three.
John Burnett, NPR News.
John Burnett is a correspondent for NPR News based in Austin, who covers stories across the southwestern U.S. He helped lead NPR's coverage of our city here, New Orleans, before and after Hurricane Katrina, and he's a regular contributor to programs like Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. And this is All Things New Orleans from WWNO. Listen to us anytime online at WWNO.org. All our articles and features are archived there. I'm Jack Hoppe. Okay, by 2050, that's not far off, it is projected that 70% of the people around the world will live in urban places. Now, here in the United States, more than 70% of us already live in cities, big or small, or in their suburbs. In fact, this is being described as the urban century. In the coming weeks, NPR's Robert Siegel will speak with a handful of reporters about how Americans want to live in the urban century. Their project started right here in New Orleans with this report from Debbie Elliott.
First, tell us, why New Orleans?
Well, you know, after Hurricane Katrina struck in 2005, this city really became a blank slate. And in the years that followed, there have just been all these entrepreneurs coming here to sort of think about how the city operates, how to reinvent itself. It's really become a hotbed of entrepreneurship.
And you were there to tell us about a project that's part of an effort to, as I understand it, democratize what shows up in our communities.
Right. It's a social media tool. It's called Neighborland, and it's a lot like Twitter. You go to this site, and you pick out your neighborhood, and there's a conversation going on, and you join in the conversation. The post will all start with, I want, and you fill in the blank, and you say what your idea is for your neighborhood. And one of the top ideas here is getting a streetcar line through downtown. An idea first proposed on Neighborland by Jasmine Fournier, a young healthcare worker.
We are at Dauphine and Canal Street, waiting for the streetcar, and it's on its way.
Fournier has a new house on St. Claude Avenue downtown. The city has federal funds to add a new streetcar line on the avenue, but Fournier wants to see it extended further. She thinks it will help her block feel more connected.
It's not a street. It's not something that someone's driving down really fast to get through. It's a place where people are stopping. And that's how you have a neighborhood, is like people stop.
Claiborne.
Fournier likes Neighborland because it allows her to be an advocate without attending endless meetings or otherwise disrupting her busy life. And that's exactly how the site's co-founder, Candy Chang, envisioned it, a tool for those who don't have the loudest voice or the time to show up at City Hall. As we walk to a corner cafe on St. Claude, Chang describes what got her thinking about how neighbors connect.
I feel like there's more and more tools to reach out across the world, but it's still hard to reach out to your entire neighborhood.
Chang is an artist and an urban designer. Neighborland grew out of one of her public street art projects.
What if it was easier for us to say what we want, where we want it? So I made these stickers, these fill-in-the-blank stickers that say, I wish this was blank.
They look like those generic name tags that say, hello, my name is Debbie. She posted the stickers on empty storefronts around New Orleans.
People wanted a bakery, a nursery, a taco stand, a place to sit and talk. I really like how in this little small space, the responses range from like the very functional to the really poetic too. So people said, I wish this was heaven, Brad Pitt's house.
One of the most popular posts in her neighborhood, the Bywater, both on stickers and online, is, I wish this was a grocery store. Chang says the lone supermarket, pre-Katrina, hasn't reopened, so a Mardi Gras party store has helped fill the void, along with Mr. Okra, the local produce vendor.
I'll hear his voice.
I have the mango.
I got bananas.
I have
pamphlets. It's like, oh my God, Mr. Okra. And you run out like he's the ice cream man.
Mr. Okra, pastel-painted shotgun houses, and streetcars are just some of the hallmarks of New Orleans, a city still reinventing itself in the wake of Katrina. Neighborland is one of dozens of entrepreneurial endeavors that have sprung up in the recovery. To find out if local officials are paying attention, I go to City Hall, where Councilwoman Kristen Gislason-Palmer says Neighborland's timing is good.
You know, after the storm, everybody was fighting. You fight so hard for, you know, what is that sense of community and that discussion of neighborhood and planning and what's really important to you. And I think Neighborland kind of reflects that. You literally are putting your stamp on it.
But so far, only a few hundred residents are using Neighborland, and it's hard to gauge yet what impact, if any, they've had in the project's first year. The bottom-up, democratic nature of Neighborland is not an easy sell when it comes to developers, driven more by market forecasts than citizen whims. One exception is Wisnia Architecture and Development, a firm that has turned a long-abandoned office building, Saratoga, into apartments on a corner near City Hall, the public library, and a very busy bus stop. A sign on the ground floor asks, what businesses do you want here? And gives a number to text in answers. Wisnia architect Dan Weiner says they've received dozens of suggestions that were practical.
And have actually helped us form ideas on how these spaces can be put into commerce and make sense, not just from the developer standpoint, but from the community standpoint.
Here are some ideas I heard down at the bus stop.
I think most importantly, they needed some type of activity center down here.
Hell, maybe they should open up an arcade. They don't have any of those around anymore. That way, maybe I could go in and play a game or two while I wait for the bus.
Restaurant.
Maintenance worker Michael Ray is waiting for the Algiers Loop bus to take him home.
They can put a liquor store in there. Yeah, somewhere I can buy a cold beer. I'm here every day.
Ray likes the idea of having a say in local development, but like a significant part of New Orleans' population, he's not really engaged in social media.
I'm computer illiterate. That's some of us in the world, you know.
So you don't have a computer. Now, do you have a cell phone?
Yes, I have a cell phone. I don't do texts, though.
Early on, Neighborland's users appear to be mostly white, educated, middle-class professionals. People like Jasmine Fournier, who have flocked to the city to be a part of the new entrepreneurial vibe here post-Katrina. From the front stoop of her double shotgun house on St. Claude, you can see the signs of long-term neglect on the block. Dilapidated storefronts, and a few small businesses like the Payday Loan Shop a few doors down. Getting a new streetcar, she believes, can start to change that.
I'm here to watch the neighborhood come back and watch the check place turn into maybe a grocery store or something that would be useful for people around here.
Jasmine Fournier hopes the St. Claude streetcar line will soon be stopping on her block. On the corner of St. Claude and Frenchman in New Orleans, Debbie Elliott for the NPR Cities Project.
The website Debbie was discussing, neighborland.com, is open for input from more than 20 cities so that people can suggest what they want where they live. And it's All Things New Orleans here on this 2nd of August. Fresh Air follows us at 7 tonight. Mark Schlifstein, you've heard us say that name before. He was called the Prophet of Katrina's Wrath for his pre-storm prediction of New Orleans' vulnerability to flooding. So when the owners of the Times-Picayune cut the staff by half, this Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist had to make a decision. Should he stay or should he go? Schlifstein decided to stay with the newspaper and recently talked about that decision with Robin Young, the host of Here and Now.
We know you're getting close to retirement, so you wanted to retire there, but why else did you decide to stay, even though there's a lot of anger at the cutbacks?
I see this as a way of continuing my role of reporting on key issues involving the safety of New Orleans, including issues involving coastal restoration and the hurricane risk reduction system.
You felt a responsibility to that. Well, and for the last 2 years, most of your reporting has centered on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Catch us up on where we are. We remember when there were payouts made to people who were directly impacted by the spill, but we know that there's some debate swirling right now about a settlement and possible more payments. What's going on?
Basically, where we are is we're in this period where we're waiting to see whether or not the federal government and the states are able to reach a settlement with BP over Clean Water Act fines and over their public damages claims. And that could be literally in the billions of dollars. And then waiting in the wings is a natural resource damage assessment process, which is a separate part of the Oil Pollution Act. And that could be an additional several billions of dollars based on what kind of actual damages have been done by this spill to the environment, which are still, that's still an area that people are waiting to see exactly what's happened.
Right. And what about protection? The Army Corps of Engineers recently installed the last blocks of this 130-mile levee system that goes around New Orleans. The New York Times says it gives every appearance of strength and permanence. Your thoughts?
It does. It is a significantly improved system compared to what was in New Orleans prior to Hurricane Katrina. The easiest example of that is on the eastern side of the city. The levees prior to Katrina were maybe 15 feet high, should have been 17 and a half feet high prior to Katrina. Today, they're a combination of levee and flood wall that's 32 feet high. So that's a dramatic improvement. However, the thing to remember, though, is that that's still a system that is aimed at reducing the storm surge from a 100-year storm. In Hurricane Katrina, the way it hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast was a 400-year storm, and the way it hit that part of the Louisiana coast that I was just talking about was somewhere between a 200- and 250-year storm. So if it happened again, you would still see overtopping. The difference is that this system is designed to stay there once it is overtopped. And if they have been successful in building it that way, that means that the amount of flooding that would occur, even in an overtopping situation, would be significantly less than happened during Katrina.
Well, Mark Schlifstein, we hope to stay in touch with you as you stay at the reduced but still terrific Times-Picayune. And a shout-out to our new listeners there on WWNO, how they are feeling, post-Katrina. Do they feel safer? But, Mark, as you write about post-Katrina, is it hard to get people to pay attention now, or are people there still, demanding of you that you stay on the case?
It is an extremely important area for me to continue to cover, and there is a lot of interest in it, not only from the question of whether or not we're safe to be here and what do all these things mean to us in that context, but also in terms of the fact that both the reconstruction of the levee system and this coastal restoration process that's going to continue for the next 20 to 50 years, that's going to be a future job source for the New Orleans metropolitan area for quite a while. And so everybody is going to be very interested in that.
Mark Schlifstein, Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental reporter, still with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Mark, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Mark Schlifstein is a member of the board of directors of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He's been with the Times-Picayune since 1984, covering many different subjects. I certainly hope you've enjoyed this evening's edition of All Things New Orleans. My associate producer and editor on the program is Thomas Walsh, ATNO, also airs On Monday afternoons at 1:35, we'll have a new program for you then. But you can listen to our features online anytime at wwno.org. I'm Jack Hopke. Thanks again for joining us.